And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Daniel Brook to the program today. Daniel is a writer of nonfiction, and his journalism has appeared in Harper's, The Nation, and The New York Times Magazine. His books are The Trap, A History of Future Cities, and his most recent one, which we'll be talking about today, The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction, which is published by W.W. Norton. Daniel, the title of your previous book was A History of Future Cities, and while the title of the new book is The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction, it is also very much about cities, particularly those of New Orleans and Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah, I'm really glad you picked up on that. A lot of people looking at my previous work and then this think, oh, you have very eclectic interests. I don't see how all of this is related. But they are very clearly related through my interest in the cities, the political and cosmopolitan possibilities of the cities. You could almost make an argument that the first page of this book fits with the last page of my last book. My last book, A History of Future Cities, ends with a discussion of the creation of Europe and Asia. Now, any four-year-old who looks at a map will tell you that Europe and Asia are the same piece of land. But as adults, we've been taught that there's some border we can't see.
The Ural Mountains.
The Ural Mountains. That was the border we were taught. The Ural Mountains, I hate to break it to everyone, they're kind of like the Appalachians. You could hike them in the Middle Ages without a horse. There's no great barrier. The idea that Europe and Asia were separate places comes from the ancient Greeks, and their Europe-Asia border was just the sea separating them from what's now Turkey, which, again, you could sail across in a day, even in ancient times. They created this Europe-Asia distinction to make themselves feel better, say, well, we're civilized Europeans and the Asians across the way are barbarians. That's where my last book ends. And my first book begins with the creation of white people and black people in the United States, created by and for very similar reasons. There's no clear, hard and fast delineation between white people and black people, especially in the United States, where people from Europe and people from Africa have been mixing for hundreds of years, and even more so in the cities I was particularly focused on, New Orleans and Charleston, where biracial identity was out in the open for hundreds of years before the Civil War destroyed that concept.
The polyglot gumbo that New Orleans was prior to the Louisiana Purchase is a better known subject, but Charleston not nearly as much. How did they become a city that had so many biracial people in it?
Yeah, Charleston was a surprise to me in my research. New Orleans famously is a Latin American city before it's an American city. Literally, it's a creation of France and Spain. It's purchased by the Anglo-Americans. Charleston was more surprising, as I learned in my research, was deeply, deeply linked to the Caribbean. For between 1670 and 1730, fully six of the governors of the Carolina colony, which was at that point headquartered in Charleston, were immigrants from Barbados, not immigrants from England. And as a port city linked to the Caribbean world and the Latin American world, you had a full color continuum on the streets of Charleston, not just the openly mixed European and African people who called themselves the Browns with a capital B, but also an influx from Haiti. You had a very large Jewish population, many of them actually refugees from elsewhere in Latin America, not directly from Europe or the Middle East. On the streets of Charleston, as on the streets of New Orleans, you have a kind of seamless continuum of color, and it creates a very different social world than you have not just most southern cities, but most American cities, to the extent that a handful of cities in the north do have significant African-American populations at that time.
What were some of the commonalities and differences between the Creole population of New Orleans and the brown population of Charleston?
The brown population of Charleston finds itself under even more stress than the Creole of color population in New Orleans, because their city is an Anglo-American settlement, even though it has a little bit of this Caribbean or Latin American flavor to it. And in part, that's what spurs them to found something called the Brown Fellowship Society, a social institution specifically for people who are brown. We would tend to think of brown as meaning, oh, that means, well, we're not white and we're certainly not black, we're brown. But it's more, we are white and we are black, we're brown. And these people do have good relationships until Reconstruction collapses with both their white relatives and their African-American relatives. In New Orleans, because it has this almost 100-year history as truly a Latin American city, there's more room for these openly biracial people. You don't necessarily need something in New Orleans as overt as a Brown Fellowship Society. The Creoles of color are an accepted population in New Orleans in the first censuses that are taken in New Orleans after the purchase, 1810, 1820, 1830. There are actually more mixed-race free people of color than there are enslaved Americans in New Orleans. So this is just, they make up the heart of the middle class of the city. So they're not under that same kind of stress. Moreover, Louisiana is unique in the Union at this period, where mixed-race people are presumed to be free rather than enslaved. So because they're not under the same intense stress, there's less impetus to create these overt defenses of the community. At the same time, there are restrictions. So when the Americans take over New Orleans, Thomas Jefferson, the Louisiana purchaser, puts a buddy of his from Virginia, William C.C. Claiborne, in charge of the new settlement. And he's the first governor of Louisiana. He's a friend from Virginia. Like Jefferson, he grows up on a slave plantation that he will inherit from his parents, inherit the individual and enslaved people on the plantation as well. And he gets to New Orleans and he sees this social world where there are more free people of color than enslaved people of color and thinks this is going to be very difficult. His strategy is it's too late to stop the racial mixing, but we can at least make sure it doesn't go on any further. So they create an anti-miscegenation law. This is a law against mixed-race marriage. But in Louisiana, the law applies differently than anywhere else in America. The Louisiana anti-miscegenation law requires white people to marry other white people, black people to marry other black people, and biracial people to marry other biracial people, never white people or black people. So even in trying to stop the expansion of this community, he has to acknowledge that this already exists and will always exist.
And it points to there was no hard and fast rule about who was black and who was white. There were different local norms, and that it seemed as the 19th century went on, it became more and more restrictive on who was allowed to join the white race, at least if they had any African heritage in their past.
Correct. Yeah, we tend to think, and I tended to think before I began the research on this book, that the racial system in America, whatever our feelings about it, is something that's essentially always existed, as it does today. And that's not true. The racial system in its current form really does come out of this period, the collapse of Reconstruction. It's further along in places like Virginia in the early 1800s than it is in places like Charleston and New Orleans. And I think that's why the cities I'm writing about saw such outsized civil rights progress, because these ideas had not yet been imposed upon them. But as I say, the full idea of a white person and a black person does not congeal until the collapse of Reconstruction. The one-drop rule, which I think we're all familiar with, is only invented in 1850s by Charlottesville, Virginia newspaper editor who claims he can spot an American with one African great-great-grandparent and 31 European great-great-grandparents by examining the individual's feet.
And of course, we all walk around barefoot to be
identified. We all do, yes. Furthermore, there's this expansion of whiteness that I think is central to the destruction of Reconstruction, particularly in New Orleans. As I said, these cities, both of them have this full continuum of color. And whiteness expands to encompass all of the people I describe initially as the allies at the fringes of whiteness, allies to the civil rights movement, which include Jewish Americans, Italian Americans, Arab Americans, and Latino Americans, all become encompassed in this concept of a white person by the end of this. It almost ends up like a sadistic game of tag played by 11-year-old boys, where all the boys team up on one boy to humiliate him.
Then caught up in this expansion of whiteness on who's allowed in also leaves another significant ethnic group out, and that is Chinese Americans, who came over to help build the railroads and settled all over the South, especially down in Mississippi. They ran a lot of grocery stores down in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. How did they fare in these racial restrictive laws that were supposed to penalize black people? Which side did they get caught on?
Chinese Americans have a long history in this country and often find themselves on different sides of racial lines, basically depending on how large the Chinese community is. Racial lines are drawn cynically to preserve the power of powerful people. In places like California, where there are enough Chinese to be a political threat to the powers that be, there's a lot of anti-Chinese legislation. In a place like New Orleans at the time of the Civil War, where there are so few Chinese, no one in power is afraid of them, they're actually enlisted in the white Confederate unit rather than the Creole of color Confederate unit at the outset of the war. In going on into the Jim Crow era, the whiteness or coloredness of Chinese people is litigated many times, including a famous case out of Mississippi that was the subject of a book a few years ago. It's a school desegregation case and it hinges on whether, I believe, a Chinese girl who's elementary school age is supposed to enroll in the white or colored school in the Mississippi town she lives in.
I'll put a link. We had that author on as well, so I'll put her link on there for our listeners. Now, you mentioned Haiti earlier. Do you think that the successful nature of the Haitian Revolution led to a crackdown by slave owners in that time?
The Haitian Revolution plays a really interesting and in some ways contradictory role in the book. After the Haitian Revolution, there's a large influx of refugees from Haiti that pours into principally New Orleans and secondarily Charleston. Now, who flees a successful slave revolt? Generally, slave owners. So a lot of the people who come ashore in New Orleans and Charleston from Haiti are mixed-race owners of slaves and often bringing with them some of the people they own. And this, again, doubles down on the sort of un-American social structures of both of these cities. All of a sudden, you have these wealthy mixed-race people who are slave owners themselves voluntarily moving to America. Up to that point, the only people of African descent voluntarily moving to the United States to live in a place where slavery is legal on purpose. And they're processed psychologically in a very confusing way. Even though they're politically pro-slavery, the slave owners who come ashore, the white power structures in New Orleans and Charleston are very wary of them. They think just the knowledge that they're going to spread that there had been a successful slave revolt on Haiti is going to lead to uprisings and slave revolts in the United States. Furthermore, the idea of an African-American slave owner, which I think makes us uncomfortable to this day, is not in that period an argument for maintaining slavery. As the rationale for slavery becomes increasingly race-based, the idea that people of African descent can successfully own and run a slave plantation actually becomes an argument for abolition. That if people of African descent have these capacities, why should Africans be held in bondage at all?
It seemed that prior to the Civil War, that people of mixed race and free people of color often tried to ally themselves with the power structure because they knew what side their bread was buttered on.
Yeah. Initially, these communities try to ingratiate themselves with the white power structures. We should remember the white power structures are generally their relatives, openly acknowledged relatives. It's not like the white power structure is strangers. It's like their uncle, their dad, their grandpa. But they're also under an incredible amount of stress, as I said, as the rationale for slavery becomes increasingly race-based. There's a rising tide of racism, and how they're going to fit into the society as they were becomes less and less tenable. So they're often very vocal in their support of slavery. They doth protest too much. They're almost being so vocal about support for slavery, clearly in an attempt to dodge the wrath of the worst of the racists. And you can see how ultimately this is not going to work out for them. And at the Civil War, they do switch sides. Literally, many of them fight for the Confederacy and then switch to fight for the Union. And certainly in the Reconstruction period, they are the leaders of this first civil rights movement in league, as I say, with allies at the fringes of whiteness and their main base of support, the freedmen, the emancipated slaves.
Because they see that their fate is tied with their cousins, the freedmen.
They see that in any version of America where rights are assigned on the basis of race, they are going to be discriminated against.
Let's go to the future just a little bit, 1930. Mm-hmm. Who was Williston Henry Lofton, and what role did he play in your research?
Williston Henry Lofton was an undergraduate at Howard University in late 1920s, and he decides he wants to get a master's degree in history along with his bachelor's degree. He's very ambitious. Subsequently, he does become a history professor at Howard. And he searches around for a master's thesis topic, and he decides he's going to write about the civil rights movement. By the civil rights movement, he means the movement in the 1860s and 1870s for African American equal rights, not, of course, the civil rights movement that we think of as the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And I came across his thesis doing a catalog search on the internet for work about this period. It came up on an internet search. The title of his master's thesis is Civil Rights of the Negro in the United States, 1865 to 1883. And I thought the title and then the selections I read from it were so interesting that I did go to the Howard University Library, where this unpublished thesis from 1930 exists, the only copy in the world, And I ended up using that as the introduction to my book, quoting a bit from the very first page of his thesis. His thesis opens, quote, "A study of the civil rights of the Negroes in the United States in the two decades following the Civil War reveals surprising information to the investigator. The surprise exists not so much in the denial of civil rights to the Negro, for that is expected, but rather in the great degree to which civil rights were accorded to the Negro by both the state and federal governments."
And it's just amazing to see in these cases that follow the Civil War and African Americans trying to secure equal treatment under the law that these are the exact same court cases we're going to see 80 and 90 years after during the 20th century civil rights movement.
Yeah, exactly. It's very chilling if you compare the Civil Rights Act of 1875 with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The substance of those two bills are almost identical. They deal with equal access to public accommodations. What's so chilling and awful is that the Civil Rights Act of 1875 is struck down as unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court in 1883. So this law that Congress had passed, that had been signed by President Grant, that was on the books, was struck down by the Supreme Court, and then an equivalent law could not be passed until 1964, in part because of the disenfranchisement of African-American voters in the South, rendering the blackest region in the country the most hostile to black rights for decades.
It's chilling to look at a comparison today when, as Reconstruction ends and the period of what they called redemption begins in the South of white supremacy that leads into Jim Crow, you have the Supreme Court of the United States with no moral will to help out its own citizens. And you see that just happened as we taped yesterday with the Supreme Court's ruling on gerrymandering.
Yeah, the Supreme Court does not come out looking very good in this book. Many of the laws passed by Congress to support civil rights are struck down by the Supreme Court in this period. Arguably even worse, many of the constitutional amendments that remain on the books in this period are interpreted so cynically as to render them completely powerless. For example, the 15th Amendment guarantees all American men as adults the right to vote. Then there's a Supreme Court case after the collapse of Reconstruction that rules that the 15th Amendment enfranchises no one. All it means is men cannot be denied the right to vote because of race. They can be denied the right to vote for all other reasons that are not race, such as failure to pass a literacy test. Of course, as we know, these literacy tests were then capriciously administered by registrars all over the South. They can be disenfranchised out of poverty if they cannot pay a poll tax. All of a sudden, you have poll taxes all over the South. So the role the Supreme Court plays in this period is very nefarious in terms of thwarting the will of Congress and the will of the people. And I think it does foreshadow the worst possibilities of that institution.
We can also see in North Carolina with their voter ID rules that they researched which types of IDs African Americans had and tried to outlaw those as forms
of
ID.
I always thought before writing this book, kind of naively, like, oh, in the olden days, racism was just a lot more out in the open and obvious. And if people were disenfranchising African Americans, they would just come out and say it. You do have a few instances where people do come out and say it, but it's much more common to do it in these types of ways. Like in South Carolina, at the end of Reconstruction, they get rid of polling places in rural African-American communities. Closing polling places is still a tactic used today.
Well, in Alabama, they shut down driver's license bureaus in majority black counties.
Yes, exactly. You also see the transportation issue in its own way is similar in Reconstruction period, where there are these public ferries in the river country of South Carolina that mysteriously go out of service on election day. So the wealthier, whiter people have their own private boats or horses, and they can get to the polling place. But the poorer, more disproportionately African-American population rely on the public ferries and can't get there. It's similar to who has access to transportation today. They're often putting polling places in places that are inaccessible by public transit. So people who don't have easy access to an automobile or truck can't vote.
And even in Texas, one legislature proposed a law that would make it illegal to give someone else a ride to a polling place.
Well, yeah, the more things change, the more they stay the same in this country, unfortunately.
It might be instructive for us to follow the vicissitudes of one notable person during this time. Could you tell us about Francis Lewis Cardozo and his legal status and how it changed over the years?
Sure. Francis Lewis Cardozo is one of my favorite characters in the book, characters being a term nonfiction writers use to talk about real people who lived, who figure prominently in our work. Francis Lewis Cardozo was born in 1836. He's a brown Charlestonian. His father is Sephardic Jewish. which means a Jewish person with roots in Spain before the Inquisition. His mother is mixed African-American and Native American. So young Mr. Cardozo has this identity that he almost sounds like a millennial to me. He has this identity that spans all of these categories that we generally think of as mutually exclusive, most clearly black and white, but also immigrant or indigenous, Jewish and Christian, Anglo and Latino, and then, you know, grandson of immigrants or grandson of people brought to this country in slave ships and chains. He's all of these things. And he becomes a major leader during Reconstruction. Equal education is his great passion. Though he's of Jewish background, he's an ordained minister. He comes out of the church. He runs schools in Charleston to try to educate people like himself of the younger generation. So when he is coming of age, his father wants to get him a college education, and there's no college in America at that time that's going to educate him. So he dispatches him to Europe, and Francis Cardozo ends up studying at the University of Glasgow in Scotland to get his degree. So he wants to create a better America where people of color can be educated. He's the driving force at the state constitutional convention in 1868 in South Carolina in getting a plank in the state constitution that guarantees non-discrimination in universities and public schools. The public schools aspect only really comes together in New Orleans. It's kicked down the road a bit in South Carolina and never quite gets done. But the university desegregation does happen, largely because Cardozo has been elected first Secretary of State and then Secretary of Treasury and sent to Columbia, the state capital, also home of the University of South Carolina. And he's the driving force behind desegregating the University of South Carolina, which is done in 1873 and then is undone in 1877, tragically.
The name should sound familiar. He is a relation of Benjamin Cardozo, Supreme Court Justice and the namesake of Cardozo School of Law.
Yes. The Cardozo family is very illustrious in both its white-identified and African-American-identified branches or mixed-identified branches. But under Jim Crow, these multiracial families fracture along different lines. The Cardozo family, it's very sad. Ostensibly, the white side of Cardozo, which is openly Latino and Jewish, but now this is conceptually white at this period. The scion of that family is Benjamin Nathan Cardozo, who becomes a Supreme Court justice in 1932. Meanwhile, just 2 miles away in a red line neighborhood near Howard University in Washington, D.C., the mixed side has founded a business called Cardozo Sisters Hairstylists, which is an African-American hairstylist parlor. Actually, both sides of the family are doing well in this period within the restrictions put on them. But just think of how different the opportunities are for white-identified people and African-American-identified people. The white scion is on the United States Supreme Court, and the African-American sisters run a successful small business.
And while the struggle is fierce in New Orleans and Charleston to gain more equal rights, it's particularly galling that when men of mixed race and color are elected to federal office, being representatives or senators, they go to Washington, D.C. and enjoy less freedom in the nation's capital than they would back in their home areas.
Yeah, this is a galling and, to me, surprising part of my research, which is that, as you said, when the representatives largely from South Carolina and Louisiana are sent to the United States House, you also have famously have a senator, a mixed-race senator, mixed in many ways, African-American, European-American, and Native American, Hiram Revels, sworn in as senator from Mississippi. When they go to Washington, they often experience more discrimination than they had faced in their hometowns. I mean, by the time these gentlemen from Charleston are being sent to the Capitol, and there are actually three different Charlestonians representing different districts, as I said, this community plays a very outsized role. They're always complaining, like, I can ride the streetcars in Charleston. Why do I get discriminated against on the streetcars in Virginia or even Washington, D.C.? I can go to the theater in Charleston, but I have trouble going to the theater in Washington, D.C. It somewhat flips the script on the assumptions we make about North and South in this period.
To think that they're trying to integrate the schools of New Orleans and so many of the schools in the North and out West haven't even become close to being integrated themselves.
Correct. Yeah. That aspect was surprising and interesting to me. The other aspect is that after Reconstruction collapses in the South, particularly in these cities, a kind of diaspora of civil rights activists fans out around America, and they become responsible for bringing civil rights to the North and the West. So one of my characters, the first African-American valedictorian of the University of South Carolina, he's class of 1877, the last class that's integrated. He moves to Brooklyn, New York, gets himself on the school board, and desegregates the Brooklyn public schools. One of the white characters. Henry Dibble, he's originally from Indiana. He settles in New Orleans after the war, in part because he's wounded in battle and moves in with his aunt, who lives in New Orleans. Like, we, again, think of North and South as like, there are Northerners and there are Southerners. It's like, no, you could grow up in Indiana and your aunt might live in New Orleans, just like today. Not that strange. So he settles in New Orleans. He ends up being the judge who issues the court order to desegregate the New Orleans public schools. As Reconstruction collapses, he's actually harassed on the streets. He's really run out of town. And he moves to San Francisco, California. He ends up getting himself elected to the State House of California. He becomes Speaker of the State House of California, and he writes and passes the first civil rights law in the history of the state of California.
There's enough villainy for the entire country at this time, but one person that sticks out in particular and consistently is Robert Mills Lusher of Louisiana.
Yeah, Robert Mills Lusher, tragically and awfully, for whom the leading public magnet school is still named to this day in New Orleans, is just a character of such villainy, it's almost cartoonish. He makes whites-only education the great cause of his life. And in researching the book, I found a document that really helped me bring his dastardly villainy to life. He wrote, hand-wrote, roughly, I think, 25-page, long pages, small print, autobiography in the third person about how great this man, Robert Mills Lusher, e.g. the author, was, and how he committed his life to preserving the purity of precious white children and maintaining the supremacy of the Caucasian race. So I had all of these quotes from this handwritten autobiography that's housed in the archive at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge to draw from to bring this character to life.
In this time, we see all the extra-legal and extrajudicial means that white supremacy tried to gain power with white leagues and the Klan defying the law openly. Mm-hmm. And it's very reminiscent of what recently happened in Oregon with militia threatening the Democratic legislature.
Yeah. In this period, you have a number of, I think it's fair to call them terrorist groups, that are created to reassert white supremacy through violence. As you mentioned, in the rural South, it is mostly the Klan. Ku Klux Klan, and they famously wear their hoods. In New Orleans, it's something called the Crescent City White League, which does not wear hoods. They drill in the open without masks. They publish their membership rolls. And you can see through their membership rolls essentially how the allies at the fringes of whiteness are peeled off towards white supremacy. It pains me greatly, but this is what I found in the archive. You have the White League rolls with the names you'd expect, like Richards and Smith and Jones, but you also have Garcia and Hyman in the White League of Crescent City.
As African Americans and people of mixed heritage are losing their rights as Reconstruction is coming to its final days, you have them threatening to out ostensibly white people as mixed race as well.
Yeah, the claim that especially the Creoles of color are making, and a claim that they're being vindicated on now as Americans do their genetic genealogy through things like Ancestry.com and 23andMe, is that they are not the only mixed-race Americans. They're just the rare Americans who aren't lying about it. And they do threaten when there's an attempt to resegregate the schools in New Orleans, that if they're thrown out, they're going to start outing the children they know who are ostensibly white but aren't. And racial passing goes to the very highest levels of Louisiana society. The congressman who takes office after the collapse of Reconstruction, the first white supremacist to represent New Orleans since before the Civil War, is a man named Randall Lee Gibson, and he is secretly descended from a free man of color. His family has been lying about this for so many generations that it's almost certain that Randall Lee Gibson himself has no idea he's of African descent. The family has many stories about why every so often one of the children is born with dark skin. They say their go-to stories, they're descended from an English lord who fell for a gypsy maid, which is great. We're so dark because we're British royalty. but then they're alternate. We're part Sephardic Jewish, we're part Turkish, we're part Arab, anything but the sub-Saharan truth.
Yeah, it was like those legends that grew up around the Melungeon people in the Appalachians on, you know, it was the Portuguese,
yes.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, and then you do, in the Jim Crow era, the book traces these characters in the conclusion, some of them into the Jim Crow era. And there you have these disownments along many different lines. I mentioned the Cardozo family breaking along white and mixed lines, but you also have intergenerational disownment. So Richard T. Greener, who's the first non-white graduate of Harvard. He's a mixed-race man who is the first non-white professor at the University of South Carolina in the desegregated period. His daughter calls herself Belle da Costa Green, says she's a Latina of Portuguese descent, and she becomes the librarian to J.P. Morgan, the banking magnate in New York City, and builds his Morgan Library. She's the point person going to Europe, going to the auctions, buying the illuminated manuscripts, but all of it at the price of not acknowledging her father, who is a man you'd think any daughter would be proud to have as a father, one of the most accomplished Americans of the late 19th century. You also get families fracturing in an arguably even more painful way. Homer Plessy, the famous plaintiff in the case against segregation that is lost at the Supreme Court in 1896, Homer Plessy is described as an octoroon, someone of 7/8 European descent, 1/8 African descent. The African American newspaper in town describes him as, quote, as white as the average white Southern man. On the 1920 census, he is marked as a white man, Homer Plessy, the famous civil rights plaintiff. As the Plessy family moves on into the Jim Crow era, the children are again born with different skin tones, and some of the light-skinned children would ultimately grow up to marry white people, move to the suburbs of New Orleans, and just disown their openly African-American family members in town. Just really tragic.
One of the strongest points that you make toward the end of the book is that so many of these court cases were fighting about equality of the races and were not concentrating on the ridiculousness of the idea that there are distinct races.
What struck me in at the height of Reconstruction, there are a number of civil rights cases where the pro-civil rights side keeps pointing out the kind of nebulousness of race or the impossibility of drawing a hard and fast distinction in race. The most famous case is Plessy, and Plessy goes to the Supreme Court and says, you know, because of my background, different states would categorize me as being of different races. So that's crazy. How can we say I have a race if, like, Virginia and Georgia can't agree on what race I am? In the majority opinions, famously an 8-1, the justice writing for the majority says, you know, openly admits, like, he can't say what race Homer Plessy is, and the states aren't going to agree, but each state, it's states' rights. Each state can decide what race Homer Plessy is, and they can put him in whatever rail car they want based on that. But again, the interesting thing is that even when the laws are on the books in favor of civil rights, it's the pro-civil rights side that keeps poking at the kind of nebulousness of race, which struck me because they didn't have to. They didn't have to go that direction. The whole point of the civil rights laws is like, it doesn't matter what your race is, you deserve the same treatment. So I think they realized even then that they had more hope in establishing equal rights if they could challenge the notion, the Anglo-American notion of distinct races, rather than accept it and just call for equal treatment regardless.
Now, this question calls probably for too much speculation, but I just wondered as a student of history, if you think that the object lesson of the failure of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow led to America's and the Allies' decisions to denazify Germany and Austria after the Second World War.
I don't know if you can draw a straight line between those two. I suspect certain individuals involved in making those decisions were thinking along these lines. It would actually be a wonderful research project for a PhD student or a professor to try to link those together. There is a spectacularly interesting book that came out recently that does show a link between the Nazis formulating their racial laws. Their racial scheme, of course, is not a black-white, it's a Semitic-Aryan, as they put it. And they do study the United States, particularly the southern states that have prohibited interracial marriage in order to craft their laws.
And Indian removal and Native American reservations were
a
plan for the concentration camps.
You can find Hitler quotes praising the ethnic cleansing of Native Americans in the United States.
We've had a couple of different aspects of cities. Is your next endeavor following along city lines too?
Yes. I don't want to give too much away as it's in the works, but if it is all systems go, it would bring me to the world of Weimar Berlin, and actually will develop some of these parallels between European fascist racial ideas and American white supremacist ideas.
Well, Daniel, we look forward to that.
Thank you so much.
And thank you again so much for stopping by today. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Daniel Brook is the author of The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction, which is published by W.W. Norton. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.